Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the highest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene.
Then, should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword and fire crouch for employment. But pardon, and gentles all, the flat unraised spirits that have dared on this unworthy scaffold to bring forth so great an object. Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or may we cram within this wooded O the casks that did affright the air at Agincourt?
Oh, pardon, since a crooked figure may attest in little place a million, and let us ciphers to this great accompt on your imaginary forces work. Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now confined two mighty monarchies, whose high upreared and abutting fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. Peace, out our imperfections with your thoughts, into a thousand parts divide on man, and make imaginary puissance.
Think, when we talk of horses, that you see them printing their proud hoofs at the receiving earth. For 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings. Carry them here and there, jumping o'er times, turning the accomplishment of many years into an hourglass. For the which supply?
Admit me, chorus, to this history, who, podcast-like, your humble patience pray, gently to hear, kindly to judge, our podcast.
Did I make any errors?
Didn't like that bit.
No, I did. I actually like it. I like it.
One error, that's fine. Here we are. We have arrived at this week's play, which is what, Wolf?
Henry the Fifth.
Excellent. Fantastic. So, Henry the Fifth. And we've chosen, or I have chosen, Henry the Fifth, the Kenneth Branagh version.
What year was this made, David?
That's a really good question. Thanks for asking.
1989, I believe.
No, very good. You've done your homework. So, I say Kenneth Branagh. I must stop. That's a terrible habit. Kenneth Branagh. All right.
Or at least clarify that you do know his real name,
indeed.
Even if you then continue to change it.
Indeed. Speak like an arse. So, why am I doing this? Ask me why I'm doing this.
David, I've been wondering, why are you doing this?
Because we have to do that at the beginning and we never forget to ask. So, I'm doing it because it's almost, or not very far away, St. George's Day. And I
But when this comes out...
Wait.
Don't you mean, today is St. George's Day?
Good point. All right. Because today is St. George's Day. It would be so much better to have thought of that before. So, and I thought, you know, we should do something for St. George's Day. It's our national day. And, you know, I don't like the fact that our national flag is appropriated by lots of horrible far-right people. So I thought we should celebrate our flag and celebrate something which is reasonably patriotic. But you know what somebody's going to say, don't you? They're going to say, why is it on St. Crispin's Day?
Oh, I see.
That's what they're going to say, aren't they? Because people are clever.
When is this?
When is St. Crispin's
Day? Yeah, when is it?
No idea. I know. Oh, I must know when Agincourt is. It's sort of October-y time, isn't it? Because it happens quite late in the season, because they don't get over until later than... Anyway, so that's what I'm doing. I'm doing it for St. George's Day, okay? My impression is, very strongly, that Shakespeare sees him as a very patriotic figure and that Henry V is a patriotic play. Whether that's true or not, we will find out.
Keep listening to find
out more.
Keep
listening to History and Technicolor. So, what about you? Do you like the play? And did you know the play beforehand?
I've seen this version of the film before.
Okay.
That's really my only interaction with the play. So, I will admit that I'm not that familiar with it.
Okay.
But I'm relatively familiar with Branagh's Shakespeare adaptations.
Right.
And okay. I will admit that I'm not that familiar with the histories, okay. Much more familiar with the tragedies and the comedies, cool. Some of the romances. So this is an interesting investigation for me.
Foray for you. So I can then ask you whether you like Shakespeare or not, although I'm guessing from what you said that you do. But
he can be boring. This should, just up front, let's just be honest.
You see, can be boring.
Can be boring can at be. Times.
At times.
Even in the good plays, there are sections that I really don't like. And I think that's just, so much has changed over time. There are sections of it which are designed for certain parts of the audience that just don't appeal as much these days. Or there'll be comedic interludes during a more serious production and I don't care as much for the deviations. But on the whole, we can't really put the man down too much. Okay. No one puts Shakespeare in a corner.
Is that what people do with other people? No, I'm slightly worried by my response to Shakespeare and I may have to, you know, the Jew and Ash Twigs may need to be deployed for a second time, as it was in Master and Commander, for liking the British Navy. So I'm slightly worried about my transition from thrusting young.
Why were you also thrusting?
Thrusting young buck to, you know, old broken down basket case. Because, you know, when you're young, you're not allowed, you don't like Shakespeare, do you? Apart from Millie, nobody likes Shakespeare when they're under the age of 95, do they? You just think, oh, what do I have to do this? Let me get outside.
I grew to like Shakespeare quite a lot during
quite
A-levels.
Old, it's got to be said.
Yeah, but during my A-levels. So when I was like 17, 18, that was when I started to appreciate Shakespeare.
17, 18. That was when maturity hit.
Yeah, that was when I started studying. I didn't like Twelfth Night when I was younger. Mm. I didn't really like Romeo and Juliet or Macbeth. But as I started to get into studying Hamlet, etc., I found it more interesting.
Okay, so you acquired maturity earlier than I did is the other way of looking at it. Because, I mean, I've always despised and hated Shakespeare and resented him, actually. But I have now found myself that actually I quite like both the histories and the tragedies, which is an outrage. The thing I can't stand up is he has a tin ear for comedy. Well, clearly, Shakespeare has no idea about comedy and he's rubbish at it. And anybody who says opposite will never be admitted to the shed.
Well, I'll be careful with my words.
No, I exaggerate for a fact, obviously. But, you know,
do you not like Midsummer Night's Dream?
No. God, I acted in that. Oh, my God, I wanted to open a vein.
But is that literally. Because you weren't funny and the audience wasn't laughing and now you have really bad memories about this?
No, it's because
and you've turned it in
the
on
play
him.
Isn't funny. But, well, some of it's horrid as well. You know, isn't that the one where poor old Malvolio looks like an arse all the time?
That's Twelfth Night.
Yeah, it's Twelfth Night.
With his yellow stockings and his garters.
Yeah, I mean, it's just horrid. Although somebody told me that it's quite about Shakespeare's reaction to Puritanism, which is quite interesting, actually.
Okay. He puts a lot of really interesting subtext into his plays, and I think I think you should read more.
Okay, right. I feel I've worked out my personal resentment now. So let us turn, Wolf, if I may call you Wolf, to the film. 1989, Kenneth Branagh, the director. I mean, the cast is just a bit of a triumph, isn't
it? A smorgasbord.
Did he
even say that properly?
A smorgasbord of British actors. So we have Derek Jacobi. We have Brian Blessed. He's excellent. We love Brian Blessed. Alex McGowan, your favourite actor of all time, who was also Bilbo Baggins, whose name is?
Ian Holm.
Robbie Coltrane.
Have you noticed that Ian Holm is in almost every movie we ever do?
That's weird, isn't it? You think, apart from Battle of Algiers, and actually, maybe he was even one of the fruit sellers in the Battle of Algiers.
Because even when we did Mary Queen of Scots, we went back and watched the 1971 version. Ian Holm
there
was
he was. Yes.
As Rizzio.
Indeed. Christian Bale, Geraldine McEwan, who's taken a break from being Marple for a while. Emma Thompson, who's a very...
Did you say Judi Dench?
I haven't said that, but it's on my list.
Okay.
I mean, could I get to the end of my sentence?
Keep,
is that right?
Keep reading.
Judi Dench. She managed to do a cameo without winning an Oscar. What was that? That outrageous Shakespeare in Love thing where she won an Oscar for literally turning up.
Was it that?
Okay. Shakespeare in Love, isn't it? Paul Scofield.
Oh, he's so good.
He is so good, isn't he? He's ridiculously good. So there's a load more I haven't recognised. But there is the most...
Richard Briers.
Richard Briers, of course, Richard Briers. You like Richard Briers,
I like
you?
Richard Briers.
Tom Good. I can't get Tom Good out of my mind.
It's because my favourite Shakespeare adaptation, at least by Kenneth Branagh, is Hamlet. And Richard Briers is an incredible Polonius.
Is he? I can't believe that.
He's very good.
People think he's talking about his vegetables.
No, he's excellent as Polonius.
Okay, very good.
Ian Holm, I think, was Polonius in the Mel Gibson version.
Is that right? I thought you were going to say that Ian Holm was Polonius' vegetable there.
No. The other version I've watched is the Mel Gibson one.
Right.
Oh, and I've seen the Larry one.
Mel Gibson did a Shakespeare.
Yeah, it's Glenn Close is Gertrude.
Right.
And Hamlet is Mel Gibson. And I'm pretty sure Ian Holm is Polonius in that version. So we can't get away from it.
How is Mel as a
not
Hamlet?
Good.
Okay, I can't imagine it. Anyway, so the most significant name, though, in that entire cast list, or the cast and crew list, is one Phyllis Dalton. Why is that? Given that this is the second time we've done this episode.
Well, this is why I don't want to cheat.
You really ought to know
this
the
answer. This is why I don't want to cheat. I don't know. Tell me, David.
Phyllis Dalton is the only person who won an Oscar. She is the costume designer. It's quite interesting. By the way, everybody, this is the second time we've done this because we did it and I had the microphone on the wrong setting for 3 episodes, actually. So all redone. So if you feel a sense of, I don't know, what sense would you have? A lack of thrust, then...
Is that because you're now a busker here, so not a thrusting young buck?
Indeed. Thrusting, busting young thruck. Now, do I need to tell you the plot? Do I actually need to? Yes, I'll take
yes.
it. There's this bloke, right? All right? This bloke conquers France.
And he has a bad haircut.
Has a really bad haircut, but not as bad as his brother's. Conquers the heart of a princess. Then the muse reminds us that everything's going to turn to poo afterwards anyway. That's essentially it. There's a battle in the middle as well.
And why does he go to war in this version?
In this version? Well, what an interesting question. So he goes to war in this question because he's tricked into not doing something else domestically that clever people at court don't want him to
do. And he's insulted by some tennis balls.
Well, he's insulted by balls, but then we're all insulted by balls, aren't we? See, it was the funniest bit in the play. It's the only funny bit in the play. The only bit we enjoyed.
Is it balls, my liege? Is that the line?
Balls, my liege. That is the only bit where we had a good time. Literally. And with simple people in Loughborough. But I mean, that's the basic theme. This guy goes and invades France because he believes in he has the right to be the king of France. And that is a right which has been around since Edward III claimed it in the marketplace in Ghent.
And then what happens at Agincourt? And why is this renowned?
You really want me to tell me the story, don't you? So, okay, there's this battle, right? So there is a battle, and traditionally the English are outnumbered by 100,000 to, about three guys and a bloke who brought the motor mower with him. And it is the great story of the English archer that brings down the flower of French chivalry in the mud at Agincourt.
And was it the first time the archer was used in this in battle?
Absolutely not. And in fact, there's quite a lot of talk. We can enjoy talking about the longbow in the historical section and how accurate that is.
Okay.
But the longbow acquired its reputation at the Battle of the Standard in 1138 when we gave the Scots a kicking. So often that happens. Boring, really. From that time, the longbow acquires its through the Hundred Years' War, Edward III, Crecy and Poitiers, that really, that's when the longbow acquires its fearsome reputation. Although it acquires very small part, and actually is used rather small amount in Poitiers. How much longer would you like me to go on about the longbow? I could talk for 3-4 hours.
You've already gone on too long.
Okay, excellent. There are some themes. You know, I'm not quite... One of the things we'll have to sort out as we go through is whether we're talking about Shakespeare or we're talking about Ken. And, of course, there'll be a bit of both. But being Shakespeare, there's rather more nuance than simply this bloke goes and, you know, wins the heart of a princess and of France. There's a bunch of themes. So there's, you know, to be a king, you need to be brutal. There's that theme that runs through it very strongly. There's a theme about are all the posh guys full of BS and the rest of us are just cannon fodder, you know, lions led by donkeys kind of theme. And there is the good old traditional honest to goodness, no poo, war as hell theme, which comes out looting of the prisoners, you know, killing of the baggage train, which we'll come to as one of the historical controversies. Okie dokes. So that is the story.
Sounds wonderful.
Do you feel you know the story now?
Yes.
Good. That's very good.
Arguably, I know the story better now than when I watched it.
Okay. So, the film as a film.
Had you seen this film before?
No. I'd managed to avoid it.
So you've never seen this?
I had never seen this film before. No, I don't think I had. I'd seen Dear Larry, I think. What about you? You hadn't seen it before.
No, I had seen this before.
Oh, you had seen this before. And have you seen Larry?
No, but I watched Laurence Olivier's Hamlet and was not too keen.
Right.
So I had kind of shied away from it a bit.
And you made me watch a clip, because I know I'd watched it in my past, but my memory of the film in the past, of Laurence Olivier's version, is of a black and white film.
I thought it was black and white as well.
So it's a bit weird that the clip you shared was in colour.
Yeah, I know.
Right, so, the film, and how good it is. So I came to it, I must admit, feeling grumpy. There's no other word for it. Grumpy, a little bit negative. You know, I wish I'd had a pint of beer with me when I watched
it. Although you did suggest it, David.
I did suggest it, I'd like to formally apologize.
You can only be so grumpy.
Indeed. Actually, I was supposed to ask you first, really, whether you liked it or not. But
No, go ahead.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was absolutely great. One of the things about Shakespeare, obviously, which is irritating, is the language. Because, you know, you think, well, no, why is he saying that? Why doesn't he just say what he means rather than all this flowery gibberish? And the language didn't get in the way at all. They did it really well. You almost didn't notice that it was incomprehensible gibberish, which is great, you know, really impressive. And William, I hope, should be duly grateful.
I'm sure he's very pleased in his grave that you think that he didn't write total incomprehensible gibberish.
I think he's delighted. Before I go on, though, what did you think about the movie? Did you enjoy it? Just generally speaking, did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it. It took a little bit longer for me to get into it, maybe because I've already seen it and I'm not that familiar with the play. So I had to get back through the language again. There's a little barrier at first. And I had to try and figure out what was going on.
Right.
I was a little bit confused by some of the plots happening right at the beginning.
Yes.
With those people who were conspiring.
Bit, I think, actually, worst bit. It's a funny place to start. You have that really good introduction from, what's his name, the Muse, not the Muse, the chorus.
Yes.
And then you get these old blokes worrying about stuff, which is, you know.
I wasn't that fond of Henry in the early part of his character development, right, when he's deciding to go off to war, but I grew to like him as the play gave him his character arc. And then the more I grew to like Henry, the more I grew to like the play.
Interesting. Right, so you're quite tied to liking this character of the king. It's interesting, because I don't think I have an opinion about whether I like him or not. He's a king. You're supposed to like kings.
But what I mean is, once I grew to understand his character, the more that he was developed, the more that he revealed complexities, the more that I could understand what he was going through, then the more interesting I found it.
And that is quite interesting, because I've always seen, because of my mental incompetence, I've never been able to really see Shakespeare characters as real people. And actually, Henry does become a real person. And even some of the plebs become real characters, and they normally never do. You know, normally just say, why are you inflicting this on me? And actually, the way Branagh plays those characters, I think, is really interesting, actually. It's probably the least effective part of the film, but I think it's the least effective part of the play. But what he does is he tries to take the comedy out and make it functional. Or this is how it seemed to me, that... So what you get is these real people interacting, and their tone of voice is different, and the kind of language they're speaking is different, because they're a different kind of people. But he doesn't try to make it funny, because we know it isn't funny. So actually it worked okay, and I felt I had some connection with those characters.
Those are the bits I don't like, because they happen quite early on. So, you know, you get that first scene with Henry, and then it cuts to Bardolph and everybody in the pub. I'm not engaged at that point, and they continue to keep me disengaged.
Right.
And because it's not funny, I'm not laughing, and then because it doesn't quite work being serious, I'm just a bit...
Right, disengaged from the whole thing. Yep. Having said that, when we come to the seminal bit, you know, the big bit where he kills Bardolph, that for me works better because he's not been a comic character before. Whereas when I was reading the play, I thought, oh, thank God they got rid of that bloke. Because he was just a comic character who wasn't funny, and therefore, you know, you're pleased to get rid of him. One of the things they do in this, which I think is really good, is although the play is apparently quite complete, you know, they cover most of it, they also bring some stuff in from Henry IV Part 2, which allows you to understand what the relationship is between Henry V and these guys, and makes it therefore complete of itself, which I think was a really good idea, actually. And you could see him worrying, or I can imagine him worrying about all the purists will say, what have you done this for? This wasn't in the play. You've ruined it, Shakespeare. You know, he doesn't worry about that. He says, look, I'm creating this thing, which is a film, happens to be based on this rather well-known play, but it's also got to work as a film.
It's absolutely brilliant. And I think just to clarify, because I didn't know this until more recently, Henry and a bunch of the other supporting characters all exist in Henry the Fourth Part 2.
Yeah.
And they've been... There's a larger story that covers multiple plays. And we see them all interacting previously. But if you just watch Henry V on its own, you wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
So I think it's absolutely genius to break the boundaries of the text.
Yeah.
And give us these flashbacks to a previous work which never exists.
Yeah.
At least in a film version, that is.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful. I think
it's really good, yeah.
It leads us on to how Branagh chooses to approach the text in general.
Mm.
He's a little bit more willing to break the rules, so to speak, and alter perceptions and try and do something new with this material. And I think that's why we get a really good film.
But my understanding is actually that he's more faithful to the text than was Laurence Olivier. The actual fact, Laurence cuts out quite a lot of stuff. I think you told me this actually, because he wants to make it more patriotic, more outwardly patriotic, because it's done in 1944, so for obvious reasons. And therefore he plays around with the text rather more. And my understanding was that Ken doesn't really mess that much with the text, apart from this sort of flashback.
No, but I think my point is about how he chooses to approach it as a film.
Yes.
His use of direction and the camera work and how he is incorporating that into his structuring of the play is what makes it more interesting, progressive and modern than other versions.
Right.
So you are correct, and I might as well tell this bit now. So, obviously, Olivier's Henry V was funded by Churchill's government and dedicated to the RAF pilots. It was obviously made during World War II, and it was propaganda to inspire the people. So they could see the parallels between the battle they were about to fight and Agincourt, where they're completely outnumbered and they're against all the odds.
Mm.
So how do they inspire all the people to let them know that they can achieve this and they can go on to win? So they removed parts of the play that wouldn't highlight their purpose, that would go against their vision of Henry V. They essentially needed to create or solidify a cult of personality, make him a nationalistic figure, a hero where there's no question of otherwise.
Yeah.
So they remove all those bits in the play which Branagh keeps and a few that Branagh doesn't keep as well, which would show a more balanced or even counter opinion of Henry and his act.
Yeah. So there's more messing about, basically.
Yeah, so one thing was they made the French more vain and incompetent,
right,
deliberately. So they made the French much worse at what they were doing to counter Henry, so that he's more clearly a sort of a hero.
Could you make the French more incompetent? I'm just a joke. That is literally just a joke. In the style of Shakespeare, you know. I love the French also.
So they made the French much more incompetent.
The best friends of French.
They made Henry more competent, and they also gave him less of a character arc from my readings, and they made him the heroic national figure that he was at the very beginning of the play, all the way through to the end.
Right.
Whereas in Branagh's version, and probably in the text as well, Henry has to overcome issues of his place in the country, his guilt over his ancestors and everything they've done, how he came to have the throne with his father being a usurper.
Yes. Interesting.
He has to weigh up his conscience about how he interacts with his men and how he leads them into this war where he doesn't know they're going to win. Obviously, in the other version, Henry is 100% certain he's going to win.
Yes.
He's like, oh, so what? There's 100,000 more of them. Yeah, come at me.
Yeah.
How about you? And he's just going to...
Yeah, we'll have him. We can have him. Yeah, give me another pint. Okay, great. Okay. And I mean, your point's about how it works, the film is interesting, because yes, I mean, you'd know better than I, but it does sound very consciously as though he's making a proper film, not just a film of a play.
Also, when we open, like we did in this podcast, Derek Jacobi is walking behind the scenes of a movie set, which is fascinating.
It works
instantly
really well,
engaged
it?
Me. Yeah. So he's walking past all the lighting rigs, all the dollies, and he's making his way through, and then they open the doors as he lets you into the play.
Yeah.
And then we get that wonderful silhouette of Henry as he appears between the two doors, lit from behind, this kind of majestic figure silhouetted.
Yeah.
And you know that what you're watching is not a standard play filmed from, you know, like two cameras on a little stage and just released as a film. This is being staged specifically for the medium of cinema.
Yeah.
And thus is going to have complex parts all moving around that try and drag sections of the play out and blow them up into this.
Yeah, very good.
Into this new work.
In fact, when he opens the the doors into the play. That, of course, is very like Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, where Maria Friedman opens the door and you've got Donnie. I mean, that's fantastic, isn't it? Anyway, moving on. We watched that last night, didn't we? Poor thing. So, totally agree. It's very cinematic. There's a certain amount of grit in the film as well, which I thought was great. You know, I expected this kind of patriotic, you know, flim-flam. And I didn't get that. You see Henry V being manipulated into war at the beginning, as we've mentioned, though it's a bit garbled, I must admit, and I only realised what they were doing when I read it up afterwards. You get quite a lot of the war as hell stuff. The bit about Henry and his chumps is quite well done, as we, well, I felt it was better done. In the middle, there's a bit just before the battle where Michael Williams is there, another actor.
For a second, I thought you meant Kenneth Williams.
Kenneth did it.
Henry.
Must do. We're going to have to do Cleopatra, aren't we? Oh, that's Sid James, but also Kenneth. Infamy. They've all got it infamy. One of the funniest lines.
Yeah, we could do. Yes.
Modern cinema. Anyway. Is that more?
I'm sorry, I've thrown you off.
It's completely thrown me off. Talking about Kenneth Williams. So yeah, there's this bit with Michael Williams, and he's playing an ordinary soldier, and he genuinely communicates real anger about the posh guys who won't risk everything, will end up walking away, being fine while they all get killed. That is quite bitter. It's quite well done. The bit where Richard Bryars is strung up as Bard officer, I think, is really well done. It's actually quite affecting, and you think, there is a genuine break with the past, and you see Branagh reflecting what this means to him.
Although he does slightly look like a member of Spinal Tap dressed as a witch.
That's always a problem.
You know exactly what I mean, though, don't you?
That's absolutely true. So, but yes, it actually makes sense, the thing. There is less grit in the film, I felt, than the play, funnily enough, which is quite an eye-opener for me, coming back and looking at the play again after A-level. And we should come to that. I was going to ask a question about our Celtic neighbours. How do you think they were dealt with in the play?
Who are our Celtic neighbours?
The Welsh. So I'm quite interested.
Are the Welsh in the play?
Yeah, of course they are. There's a Welsh captain called Llewellyn, predictably, possibly. You know.
Yes, it's Ian Holm, I remember now.
Indeed, there you go. So yes, so I'm kind of expecting a certain amount of stereotyping from an Elizabethan play. And of course, the Welsh, as you may or may not know, claim to have invented the longbow. And certainly, whether they did or didn't, Welsh contingents are very important in English and Welsh armies of the time. They play a critical role in the Hundred Years' War, and they are, you know, always recruited first, and you always have a large Welsh archer contingent.
Those are all facts that I definitely knew.
You're a liar.
No, I'm not. How dare you?
Your nose is definitely longer anyway. So, I mean, the reason I ask that, as I say, is I expect them to be treated poorly. In actual fact, Llewellyn is a very competent captain character and there's no sign of it, which I thought was quite interesting.
Is he treated fairly in the play?
I think so, yeah, from what I remember, okay. Which is, you know, 900 years ago.
I'll admit, I didn't particularly think about it or notice.
So I shoved over a little bit of a curveball, this being the second time I've done it. So I thought, I'll ask you a question.
It's really interesting.
Thank you. You know, so basically, essentially...
I'm not laughing at you. I genuinely think it's actually interesting.
Yeah, okay. So you know you're watching Shakespeare, but only just, effectively. And the other thing I really liked was some of the music, amazingly enough. There's a song in it. What did you think of the music?
I thought it was very good. What I actually wanted to ask the listeners a question. So when we were comparing the two...
You know they're not here, right?
But they'll respond in the future.
Oh, okay.
When we watched the two versions of the St. Crispin's Day... Or Crispian's Day?
Yeah.
Speech. The same piece of music plays over both of them. Because I watched them one after the other. But I don't know what piece of music it is. And I'm wondering why it's so significant that Branagh would take that piece of music from at least the Laurence Olivier version, if nothing else. And then use it again over the same speech.
Because you asked me when we're looking at that clip that you sent me about his famous speech, you know, we few, we happy few. And I didn't know. It didn't mean anything to me. So, yes, maybe your listeners can help us out. Maybe Hermione will probably.
Because I thought I recognised the music when I was watching the Larry Olivier scene.
Yeah.
And the reason was because it's in the Branagh version as well. So when I watched
maybe
that scene
back again. Maybe he was consciously echoing.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. I wondered if it was a more significant song
that I know
in
of.
General.
The song I really enjoyed was Non Nobis Domine, which is...
Classic.
Hey, Non Nobis. I'm going to tell you a funny anecdote about it. Because I can't like songs in Latin because it's embarrassing, obviously. You know, it's pretentious and it's... So when Jane and I were courting all those years ago, which is why I don't know, 1822 or whenever it was, and I'd forgotten that she was there in the car and I was listening to the Dixit Dominus, and I started singing along to the Dixit Dominus and got mocked for years. In fact, don't remind her when we go back in because
okay.
If we do, you know, I'll get mocked again for years. She's forgotten about it now. But despite that scar, it was a great song. It's the one where he's walking through the field carrying the boy.
Yes, great scene.
It's a really good song. Anyway, so I thought the music was actually quite good.
How do you feel about the battle scenes, since you've just talked about that?
The battle scenes are quite interesting. I thought the battle scenes were essentially rubbish. I'm being a little bit too strong. I mean, they cinematically, they worked absolutely fine. Historically, I don't think they were particularly accurate. And I sort of all the bit with the bowman coming in the middle and the sort of... But I could see the problem. You know, you're trying to make, with a film, you're trying to make a battle scene. I wasn't that impressed. I think it was fine, absolutely fine. And I'd say I really enjoyed the film generally. But I didn't think, God, those are great battle scenes, particularly. They're fine.
But do you appreciate that within the constraints of the play, that you have to have all these characters in the same place, not in different parts of the battlefield?
Yeah.
They have to always be talking and have the opportunity to have those discussions that we need to hear.
Yeah.
While still conveying a battle and making it...
Yeah. It's effective. Active. I agree.
It works.
Yeah, I totally agree. It works and it's effective. It was not like the beginning of Band of Brothers, but it works and it's effective.
The battle scenes were more developed and bigger than I was anticipating.
Yeah.
And there is some dedication to essentially going off script and showing pure action for a minute or two.
Yeah.
Which obviously you wouldn't necessarily get in some productions.
Indeed. I mean, I totally agree. And it's reasonably brave with the cheese. You know, he doesn't shy away from, you know, with a modern play, you might think he might shy away from doing some of the big speeches and, you know, a little bit more, I don't know, take the edges off it. He doesn't. He goes straight for it, and it works really well. The speech, the famous speech, "We few, we happy through you." It is that one, isn't it?
We band of brothers.
Yeah, we band of brothers. That works really well, I think. I don't know. What did you think?
It's very good.
Yeah.
Rewatching it again.
Yeah.
It's very impressive. Very emotive.
Yeah.
Inspiring. And what I noticed, so comparing this with the Laurence Olivier version, this is what I said to you. In the Laurence Olivier version, he starts to walk amongst the men, starts to speak to them, and it's a slow pan out as the music rises, becoming more triumphant and inspiring, and it pans out to show all the men. In the Brunard version...
I've got you into that habit there.
He pulls you in closer and closer. Yeah. There's more close-ups, the men are around him, he is one with them. And we've seen this developing throughout, especially when he walks amongst them at night. Mm. But I really enjoyed his approach where he basically puts the camera right in underneath him.
Yeah.
So he's a little bit elevated on his slightly higher stance because he gets up a little bit above them. And lets you just listen to the words and you never feel like you're outside of it or you're watching from afar. You're in there with them. He's speaking to you, every one of you. And he's making eye contact with you directly. Yeah. So you see all the emotion on his face, which you lose in the Laurence Olivier version.
No, I totally agree with you. You don't feel...
You're not disconnected, you're involved.
Yes, you are, and you don't feel awkward and think, oh, I'm being speeched at, even though you are obviously being speeched at. And actually the other one, Imitate the Action of a Tiger, Fill Out the Wall of Our English Dead and all that sort of stuff, that works very well too. And that's very difficult, actually, that one.
Is that the Once More Under the Bridge?
Yeah, Once More Under the Bridge, because that's, you know, you're in a sort of war situation and you've got to make a speech without sounding, so hang on, could you stop shooting at me? Well, hang on, whoa, just got to make a speech. Then you start trying to kill me again? Okay. You know, you've got to try and work that speech into the action. And he does it very well.
I really like that Henry is physically dirtied.
Yeah.
He's muddy, his clothes have stains on them. It's not all really well put together. He's down there in the action with everybody else. He's wounded, he has blood coming from him. He's just a soldier fighting. So when he gives these speeches, they're a little bit more believable. And also the character growth that comes through when he walks through his men that night before the battle, and when he's crying and he prays to God for guidance and repentance to kind of assuage his guilt and come to terms with who he is and how he's going to lead these men into battle. All of that happens. So by the time you get these speeches, which could be too much, you're on his side.
Yes. That's a really good point, isn't it?
If
he's false and you think, oh, it's just a cardboard cutout, then the speech won't mean too much.
It doesn't. You don't feel like he's just this ruler who you disagree with, like you say.
Yeah.
You feel like he's one of the men.
Yeah.
It's very, very,
very good.
Convincing.
I totally agree. So we love the film, effectively, before we go on to the history.
I really enjoyed it, actually.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too.
More times past, I've grown to... I didn't enjoy it that much when I was watching it, but now I think back, I could probably re-enjoy it a little bit more once I know the text better.
Yeah. Okay, very good. So as a historical record, Wolf, It's reasonably accurate to the play, as we said. The flashbacks are the main thing. We talked about those. The portrayal of Henry V is interesting. We talked about how nuanced it is, which is very good. Self-doubting, capable of doing the tough stuff, capable of viciousness, but also human and empathetic. Judgments in England about Henry V have varied very widely indeed. Not about his competence. You're going to ask me a question.
I was going to ask you what you think the play's resounding final impression of Henry is.
I think it's the impression of a human being, somebody who shows his humanity and is emotionally engaged, and yet is tough and capable of doing what a king needs to do. And for me, it presents him as doing what he needs to do rather than taking pleasure in the vicious things that he has to do, of which there is one big one.
Yes, and even though it shows him doing perhaps some questionable things, and even having traits of being maybe even a warmonger, as some people have suggested, sometimes some viewings are quite negative of him. The play does exactly what you say, yeah. And it brings it all back in to show that it's just a king doing what he has to do.
I think we ought to use the word monger a good deal more. And we are podmongers, are we not?
I guess so.
Yeah, we've got an ironmonger and a warmonger and a podmonger. Should we go and mung?
It doesn't sound quite as good as the
others.
It
doesn't sound as good. Should we go and mung some pods? That sounds gross, doesn't it?
Well, thank you, David. Continue. I just wanted to clarify what the play is saying, so then you can reconcile that with what history says.
So the historical record has been, at the time, there were very few doubts, actually. Both the English and French saw him as a model monarch who did what monarchs and ward leaders are supposed to do. You know, all our modern maithering. Back then, if you're a king, you're supposed to make war. You're supposed to beat the other guy up, and you're supposed to win glory for your house and riches for your followers. You know, stop the messing about.
It's like prison rules. Attack the biggest guy in the prison.
Yeah, and take him down.
Day one.
Indeed.
Become a king?
Papillon. Indeed. King of the castle.
Take down the biggest opponent.
Indeed. Having said that, the French, of course, have a lot of lament about the horrors of war and the violence inflicted by the horrible English. But nowhere do they doubt the fact that here is a king doing what a king ought to do, and he's done it very, very well. Since then, of course, the story has got rather more nuanced. And one of the biggest debates is about Henry's cruelty, you know. And within the play, the thing I thought was missing from the film, but actually I remember now you say it's not, is this thing about Henry killing the prisoners, which we will come to in a moment. So you then, in the mid-20th century, you get this fantastic historian called K.B. Macfarlane, who sadly didn't write very much. And so what you get is his students, who become historians, talking about their K.B. Macfarlane's influence on them, which is rather fascinating. To him, Henry is the greatest man that ever ruled England, and that's a direct quote. Incredibly competent king, a man of vision, who did things for a purpose and a reason, and followed through. In a whole range of different areas, not just about war. But more recently, historians have really knocked the edges of that. So much as there's a pop historian called Ian Mortimer, who writes very good books, who said, and I quote, "Conclusive proof that a man may be a hero and yet a monster." Nobody's taking Henry's competence away, but they are saying, actually, he does things of a viciousness that he doesn't really need to do, and he's cold. And that's the key difference with the film. A lot of the interpretations has Henry as a very cold man who doesn't doubt in the way that he does in the film.
In this, he's quite emotional.
Yeah.
So I believe when he does make the decision to kill the prisoners, which I think is shown in the film, the reason he does it is because Christian Bale's boy, the boy that he plays, has been killed.
Yeah.
And it's an act of vengeance.
Yeah.
Spurred on by disgust and sadness.
I'm going to argue about that, Andy. So I'm going to quote Shakespeare at you.
Okay.
Well, do you want to finish thought about, about Henry as a character, yeah?
Well, all I was going to say is, you were saying many people interpret him as being very cold.
Yeah.
I think this play is the opposite.
Yes, I totally agree with that. That it has him very much as an emotional, empathetic character who, as you said before,
he can be calculating.
Develops during the film, whereas for many historians, his coldness is one of the remarkable things about him. It's good that we've got the dog joining in.
Yes.
So
then, the only thing I was
together,
going to bloody dog.
Bloody dog.
I was going to add is
yeah.
When you talk about his competence, though, it's interesting that Shakespeare ends the play by telling you this is not how the situation will carry on.
Yeah, but then it'll turn to poo because he dies.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And he dies very young in 1422, just 7 years after Agincourt. And his son, Henry VI, is probably has got a serious mental illness, which affects him probably all the way through his life, and is 9 months old. His brother and his two brothers, Bedford with the extraordinarily bad haircut, and his brother Gloucester, who's quite a dude, actually, they take over, and they do very well until 1435. Then Henry VI comes to the throne, all turns to, poo, essentially, and they get chucked out by the French. At the Battle of Formigny. The history then, I think, is perfectly well done. And I feel very scared saying that because I think, everybody talks about Holinshed and how Shakespeare bases history in Holinshed and the errors in Holinshed.
But, so for the lesser well-informed of us, who was Holinshed? And
Holinshed's a 16th century historian, essentially, and he's building on a tradition of historical chroniclers, and he's created a history.
And he's the key influence
he's the key from which source, Shakespeare bases Shakespeare, as I understand it. Yeah. So
the other point I was going to add is at the same time as this, which I thought was interesting, there was quite a lot of popular Henry V plays being produced in Tudor England.
All right, okay.
So there were three other plays at least circulating at this time in the late 1580s. One was titled The Famous Victories of Henry V, containing the Honourable Battle of Agincourt. They stressed the comic and romantic aspects of the story, which appear in Shakespeare's version. They often begin with Henry's hectic youth and move through his kind of reformation and then end in the victorious conquests. And there are a variety of similarities, such as the commoners and the king, the wooing of the princess, etc. He added in the scene where he walks amongst the men.
Right.
Shakespeare openly just put that in, not based on any research. To add to the drama of the play.
And it's got to be said, all that sort of stuff, yes, when I say it's quite accurate, I mean, who knows about all that sort of stuff? I just kind of take it as read that we don't know that level of detail. And we don't know if Holinshed wrote it, how much he knew. Because, I mean, history is differently, has changed over the years. And in those days, history was as much about a story to inspire, like Herodotus talks about the reason we study history is to study the works of great men and to so that we can emulate them. It's not about the scientific method of, Thucydides introduces, shall I stop now?
No.
Thucydides introduces the idea of the scientific method, but it's a very much more recent thing, this idea that we ought to be purely searching after truth. Thomas More would write history, about Richard III as a way to instruct people in tyranny, not to tell you get the right things about Richard III. So they put words into people's mouths gaily, and that's perfectly accepted. I'm going to write this speech for Richard III. They're not claiming it ever happened. So, there's a different historical tradition around it.
But despite all of that, you think the play
So you've got to take accurate. All that sort of wordery out because you know that historians are making that up. But I mean, the reason for the war is a bit odd at the beginning. It's perfectly clear that Henry believes he has a right to France. And he does it for economic reasons as well, obviously, and reasons of dynasty. But he's reviving a claim that's well-standing. At Harfleur, the angry speech of Henry V saying that we'll kill everybody if you don't surrender, that is the rules of war at the time, accepted by everybody everywhere. If you surrendered, that's fine, you were able to walk away. If you did not surrender, you would be submitted to 3 days of sack. And there were no rules within those 3 days. If you died, that was your own fault. So that's kind of realistic.
It is interesting, though, that if you're writing a patriotic play, because I get the impression that Larry Olivier removes that speech.
Ah, okay.
I just get the impression that it's still...
Yes.
If you're trying to paint an absolutely perfect... Absolutely.
Well, this is an argument that recurs all the way through... Tediously, actually, through...
Oops, sorry.
No, I didn't mean about this. I mean, tediously, generally, on the web, on the net, on all the rest of it, saying, oh, wasn't X terrible? Wasn't it horrible that they killed all these people? The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there.
Let's not bicker about who killed who.
It is who killed who. That is a Monty Python sketch, isn't it?
Yes.
Which sketch is that?
It's from Holy Grail.
Is it? Excellent. I came across the lick raw clean with tongue thing. You remember that one?
No.
Oh, you should say that again. That's a great sketch. Anyway, so my point, yes, that's me whining slightly about, people putting foreign modern values on.
We can't imagine what it was like to live then.
Well, they had a different set of values which they lived to. And our values, will no doubt be criticised in the future. Like destroying the planet, for example. Little thing. Okay, so the French were overconfident. Their numbers are probably overstated. There's a very, there's an excellent modern historian called Anne Curry, who's sort of the guru of the Battle of Agincourt now, and she reckons that the French probably had a third extra. So that's a very different from 100,000 plays, you know, two men, a dog, and his cousin who once thought they'd seen an arrow. The battle is a mess, I'm sorry. I mean, it's not, we discussed that it's not a mess in the sense it's perfectly cinematic. But the Battle of Agincourt is theatre. It's pure theatre. And it's a bit frustrating they didn't manage to do that. I suppose it's because it was a play. So, you know, they arrive there, they're lined up, they're in this narrow channel between two woods. The French are over there, over the ploughed fields. The English have to get into charge of them, because if they don't, they're going to get murdered by all these French knights, really heavily armoured, best knights in Europe. So they have to get into charge of them so that they can mow them down, fighting on foot in the English method. So they can't get into them, so they go forward. And that's the local bloke, actually, William Camoys, who comes from Stone Park, raises a white stick and he throws it in the air and he roars strike. And they go forward and they get forward, so they get within arrow range. And eventually the French are goaded and they start charging over the muddy fields to die. They're killed by men, and that's a good thing about this play, actually, that you see the fighting on foot. It's not all this arrow stuff, because in actual fact, it's hand-to-hand fighting that, in the end, is what makes the difference. That's how the battle is fought. There's a lot of arrows going on, but they don't have that much effect. It's not like Cressy. Anyway, so it's all just a bit of a mess, but probably for the reasons you're saying. They've tried to put the bowmen in by having them there, and they're not in the play, really.
I think ultimately...
But somewhere somebody needs to make a great movie about a battle, which is pure theater.
But then I think that film is not going to be a Shakespeare production. So ultimately, when we come down to all of this, Branagh has to be faithful first and foremost to the play.
Yeah.
And then secondly, to history itself.
Yeah, and try and melt you. And that's, I think, classically what's happened in that scene. I think you're absolutely right.
Have you been to the battlefield?
No, I haven't actually, but it's just a field, I think.
I see.
Well, they've got a Wizards Centre there now, and the French, amazingly, are much better than us at celebrating things that they got kicking. But so, there's that. And there's some really nice touches. So the feeling that the Lancastrian kings have about legitimacy, which you mentioned, actually, is very realistic, because, of course, they were absolutely really worried about the fact that they were usurpers and they had the blood of Richard II on their hands. The bit we were talking about, the king of the prisoners. So here we go. In the play, it says, "The French have reinforced their scattered men. Then every soldier kill his prisoners. Give the word through." That's what it says in the play. So
simple, quick.
Simple, quick.
Pull the plaster off.
Indeed, yeah. Ow. Ooh. He kills the prisoners. It's always been a big controversy about, is this an act of, you know, vicious cruelness? And Anne Curry's view is that what happens is, so I know I'm getting a bit boring now, but I've only got another 2 hours to go on Agincourt, okay? What happens is you have these multiple charges by the French. They reform, they charge, bad blood, mud, arrows. Then
it's like I'm there.
And then back they go, and then forward come the archers. Get the villagers! And they go out and they knife fallen knights through their visor or through their neck.
Under the armpit?
Under the armpit.
That's a good one. In the groin?
In the groin.
Weak spots.
Can we stop now? And some of these knights actually died in the mud from drowning because they couldn't get out of the mud. It was so thick and gloopy. And they collect all the arrows and they scurry back like rabbits to the English lines. And forward come the French again. Bad mud, blood, and all the rest of it. The story is, according to Anne Curry, that it looks like the French have been beaten. Everybody goes forward, so the English army essentially disintegrates into bunches of men picking up stuff, you know, trying to cure themselves, whatever. And then it looks as though the French are reforming. And at that point, it is that Henry says, kill the prisoners, because he thinks he's in trouble. The French also have already killed the baggage, as you see in the film. They circle round the back. A contingent comes round, circles round the back. The idea is they're going to get Henry in the rear, as it were. But they think, oh, we've got this nice baggage train. We'll kill all those boys instead and steal all their money. So they do that. So that is a dishonourable and unmilitary act. And therefore, that creates a lot of fear. I think that's why you see it in the play quite a lot. It's kind of a justification as well. So, it represents it quite accurately. You know, the French have reinforced their scattered men, kill the prisoners. Very much in line with what Anne was saying. Okay, I think that is it, really. You know,
is it an anti-war play, and is it an anti-war film?
I don't think it's an anti-war play or film, personally. What do you think?
I think that the film, at least, because I can't truly comment on the play, has anti-war discussions?
I think it's got a war as hell bit in it. I don't think it's anti-war. I mean, it seems to me to be a thing of war is in its place here.
I guess, but does it not feel like when they open with the beginning and there's this suggestion that maybe Henry is lured into a war that he shouldn't be going to, tricked by people within his own council?
Yeah.
It slightly undermines his heroic...
It does, yeah. It makes it very political. It is a very interesting start.
It means that he's tricked into going to war, and then because he's made that blunder, he then has to save the day at the end.
Or it kind of... what's the word? It undermines the legitimacy of the war.
Yeah.
That's what it does. I don't think it has any impact on Henry as a character, but it undermines the legitimacy of the war. It's not a sort of patriotic thing of saying, hey, you know, the French have stolen our monarchy, which is rightly ours, therefore we're quite right to go over. There's no bellum justum there, is there?
I think the main thing is, although, yes, I agree it's not particularly anti-war, I also don't think it's so sickeningly...
Yeah, it's not vain, absolutely.
...inspiring that I leave this thinking, oh, the monarchy's great, yay, war's great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what impressed me more, as I think I said at the beginning, that's what impressed me quite a lot. I was kind of expecting that and didn't get that. I got quite a nuanced view with quite a deal of the war as hell and, you know, the posh guys betray the little guys.
I thought it was quite a balanced approach to all areas.
Okay. So, anything else to say about it, or have we come to the marking? And the marking shall be now.
Marking?
Three, thou shalt mark.
So with the film, I was torn between a 7 and an 8, only because I was a little bit bored in the early parts of the play. But I think its approach to the subject matter and how it adapted it is very good.
Right.
What would you say?
I'm in for an 8.
Okay.
I can really enjoy it, actually.
Yeah, I can come in at an 8. But I do believe that his version of Hamlet is significantly better.
Okay, fine. Even though it's got Richard Brydges, isn't it?
Yes, because Richard Brydges is great.
Yeah, right. Okay, I'll watch it.
Kate Winslet's Ophelia.
Is that right? She's a what?
Is Ophelia.
That was good though, wasn't it? No, okay. I'll watch
Derek Jacobi as Claudius.
Oh, if you told me that Derek Jacobi... Can we do I, Claudius?
We can think about it.
I mean, it's a TV show, obviously, but I love that. Anyway, so 8.
And accuracy, what would you say? Because I go with you on this.
I think I've got to go a bit lower than 8, haven't I? Oh, Hermione's going to kill me. I'm going to go for a 7. Maybe I should go for 6. I'm going to go for a 6. I'm going to go for a 6 because I've got a whole load of stuff in it which is, you know, demonstrably unprovable about all the chat.
Also, it's not attempting to be historically accurate.
It's not attempting to be a record of events. It's not the Battle of Algiers, no. So 6.
Okay. And I actually don't think that's necessarily a fault with it at all, because...
No. Shakespeare, you're all right, okay? We don't think it's a fault.
It's probably the best Shakespeare could do with the information they had
at
the time.
Well done, William.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Not total gibberish, William. Good work.
All right, good work, William. I think that's an excellent conclusion to our play. Good work, William. Fine. Okay, but now what we can do, which we haven't been able to do because we messed up, we've had to do it again, we can do Woody's Roundup. We can do Woody's Roundup to Das Boot.
Das Boot.
Das Boot. Quite a few other people remembered when the Boot comes in.
Yes, somebody my mum
even
did who as well.
Geordie even said, oh, did she? Even said that my Geordie accent wasn't too bad, which is just being kind, obviously, because it was obviously rubbish. So, we had quite a lot of feedback. Maybe I should do it in a more structured way, but we had a lot of love-its. So, I did a little chart here, which I do every time. I must reveal to everybody sometime about what we scored and what everybody said. So, we had 93 people who loved it, which is...
Percentage-wise, it's got to be the most. 73%
of the people who responded who had seen it, which is great. So, people love the film, and that's pretty high, actually. That's beaten by the Battle of Algiers and the Lion in Winter, but, you know, pretty much, apart from that, pretty much at the top. A little bit below Man of King George II. And almost nobody hated it. So, tiny percentage hated it. And 8 of you put it as one of my top 10 historical movies, which is quite good. Although, 75 people said Lawrence of Arabia was there. It was one of their greatest top 10 movies, which is by far the biggest.
I've actually had quite a lot of grief for how much I talked about Crimson Tide and how much I complained about...
You did get quite a lot of grief.
The Hunt for the Red October.
Would you like to apologise for that?
Multiple people messaged me like, Crimson Tide is a perfect movie, eh?
Is that right? You got a lot of personal... Agreed.
So I do think I have to admit that I was slightly hyperbolic, and it's clearly not a perfect movie. I just really like Crimson Tide.
So it was James Rowling that gave you a bit of grief about The Hunt for Red October, because James really liked The Hunt for Red October, is my impression I got. And you slagged it, essentially, didn't you?
No, I think I was maybe just a little bit too casually dismissive because I really wanted to talk about Crimson Tide.
Quite a lot of people talked about the TV show. So Stuart talked about how great that is.
Because it's a new TV show, right?
They've got new, there's a new version as well. And of course, the original one was a TV show. In fact, the one I think I saw originally was the TV one.
Lots of people like the depiction of living in a submarine.
Yeah, indeed. So a couple of people said they worked on it. Somebody said they worked on a sub base. Lynn said she worked on a sub base and really enjoyed that. Alan said thanks for mentioning him, which is fine. He's given me the £5. Alan is...
Hey, when do I get my cut?
Yeah, you don't get anything. Alan is also, of course, called Hermione, who actually made, I thought, quite a good point, which was that isn't the end a little bit mawkish, effectively? You know, when everybody dies and the boat sinks, he's got a
point. It's just a little bit too much.
It's a little bit too much. He's a little bit lazy, isn't it? That, okay. Although he's trying to do... the whole war in a campaign thing is one of the things, I guess. But
I guess, but then the other thing is, we were talking about how it makes you feel for Germans, which as British people is obviously not necessarily our inherent go-to response when we're watching a World War II movie because of how generally it's all portrayed.
Yeah.
So I do think maybe it has an impact for the rest of the world.
That may be different from us. That's probably true. And somebody did also mention there, Fat Jeff said that it must be watched in German with English subtitles to get the full impact. So maybe we ought to do that. We did do that, didn't we?
Yeah.
I watched it with English subtitles.
I'd never watch it in English.
Ian said Jürgen Prochnow, FTW. Y'all.
What does that mean, David?
I think it means for the win.
Yes.
Yes. Woo, go me. So young and modern. I'm so young and modern. Wes, you know, just enthused with us about the fact that it's a classic submarine movie. Absolutely agree. We just love it. And Wes spent 6 years upon inside a nuclear fast attack boat. Apparently made lots of jokes about sub movies, but not about this one, which is, you know, it's a bit of a compliment, isn't it? So this one clearly gets it right.
Makes sense.
Somebody knows what they're talking about, which is great. So lots of other comments, which is really good. Melanie, actually somebody was quite rude, I thought, Wolf.
About
Jen. Oh, yes, about one of your lines. Apparently you said that its length doesn't put me off at all.
I stand by that.
It's going to leave that where it is. I don't think Jen meant that. Sanaya talked about the leaky toilets. Apparently there is a sub, you know, we talked about toilets quite a lot.
Yes.
About probably more than we should have done. Apparently there is a sub which got sunk because its toilet leaked.
It's like that aeroplane that had to return back to the airport that left from because the toilets were all blocked up.
Is that right? Is it like that?
Yeah.
I suppose a little bit. And then also Melanie got involved about the conversation about how much we talked about bottoms all the time. And so I was able to show her picture of men standing in Parliament with their bottoms towards...
great stuff.
Great.
And we had a very nice review that talked about how hilarious our conversation was about fig leaves.
That's right, yes. It's just slightly embarrassing. Anyway, so everybody had a good time, was had by all, effectively. Stuart told us that we must need to watch the director's cut, so maybe we need to do that. But anyway, so everybody loved it, and we had a nice time, so that's good. So should we stop now?
Yes.
Would that be a good idea? We've scored the movie. Everybody's had a good time. The baggage train, everyone unfortunately had been killed. Sorry about that. But, you know, fortunes of war, all that sort of thing.
Would you like to read this final...
Okay.
Do you think we should just finish it off?
Let's read it. Go on then. So, everybody, we're finishing with chorus again, as we started.
Thus far, with rough and all unable pen, our bending author has pursued the story in little room confining mighty men. Mangling by starts the full course of their glory. Small time, but in that small most greatly lived this star of England. Fortune made his sword, by which the world's best garden he achieved, and of it left his son imperial lord.
Henry VI, in infant bands crowned king of France and England, did this king succeed, whose state so many had the managing, that they lost France and made his England bleed, which oft our stage has shown. And for their sake, in your fair minds, let this acceptance take. No idea what the last two lines meant. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone.
Great stuff.
Thanks for coming. Goodbye. You say goodbye as well, no?
Goodbye.
Are you not entertained?
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.